All right, so welcome everybody to a special Wade edition of the Omaha Bar Association Bar Talk podcast. I'm Dave Summers, Executive Director of the Omaha Bar Association, and I am here today with Diane Logier of Logier Corporation and Logier Foundation, who is our 2024 Laurie Smith Camp Integrity and Service Award recipient. Thank you so much for taking the time, Diane.
Thank you. Thank you, Dave. I'm really happy to be here.
So at a starting place, let's talk about Laurie Smith Camp. Judge Smith Camp, who the award is named after. I understand that you also knew her, and I'd love to get your story of how you knew her and any Laurie stories that you have for us.
Sure. I met Laurie through a book club that I'd been a part of for a long time. I think that she was in the book club the same time as I was for maybe 8 years or so before she passed away. And she just was an amazing person to get to know. She was incredibly compassionate, very open-minded. She was a Republican, and I tried not to hold that against her. She was incredibly fair, authentic, concerned about people, a lot of things that I didn't necessarily anticipate on meeting her. She was a much more genuine and warm person than I probably expected this very, very accomplished judge to be.
Exactly. Yeah, you'd see her from across the room, and she had a stately manner about her, and you wouldn't expect her to be the warm personality, caring person that she truly was.
Exactly.
Yeah. And the book club read books,
yes.
Didn't just talk about the gossip of the day, a true book club, which
no.
Laurie was a voracious reader, and I'm
yes.
sure wouldn't have that book club do anything but actually read the book, for sure.
Yes, we drank a lot of wine at the same time as we read a lot of books, but yeah. but we're pretty committed to book reading as well.
That's a true book club, and one that I've always aspired to, so that's great. And so we wanted to get you on the podcast to get your story, to hear about things that are important to you. So take us back. You know, how was your time growing up? What led you down the pathway to law school?
Well, I grew up in Minnesota, in the suburbs, and decided to go to law school. Not until I was really in college. Prior to that, I'd had some fantasy thoughts about what it would be like to be a lawyer, which were really based on no actual information at all. But in law school, made the decision that I wanted to become a lawyer, and started working a little harder in college than I had. When I started law school, I made a deal with myself, because I hated to fail things. But I made a deal that I would go one semester at a time. And if at the end of the semester I decided it really wasn't for me, or I really couldn't do the work because I knew it was going to be really hard, it would be okay if I ended that effort. And I did that for the first 2 years of law school.
There was an assessment after every semester.
There was. Wow. There was. And each time I thought, okay, I can do this. And I'm learning a lot. I felt like I learned a great deal in law school, parts of which were really valuable in my early career years, parts of which still stay with me today, and parts of which I, you know, could have done something better with my time, maybe.
And so my family, I have family up in Minneapolis, St. Paul area. Where'd you go to college? Where'd you go to law school?
I went to college in St. Cloud.
Okay.
And I went to law school at William Mitchell.
Sure.
At the time, I really couldn't afford to not work. So I worked full time. I took classes at night. Mitchell at that point was only an evening program. Mm-hmm. So your classes were anywhere from 4:30 to 10:30 at night.
Wow.
Which was exhausting. Those late classes were really not, I really wasn't very well suited to those, but it worked out.
And it was full time, you were a full time student while because those classes were one semester would be equal to a semester here at Creighton or UNL?
Yes.
Wow.
But you did take a little fewer classes so that it was expected it was going to take you 4 years okay. instead of 3 years to finish. Some people finished in 3 years. I was not one of them.
And what job or jobs were you working while in law school?
I worked for what's now Wells Fargo, mm-hmm. and I worked in their risk management area, which was really investigating Fidelity bond losses, so employee thefts, which was also a very interesting yeah. learning experience.
Yeah, an investigator for employee theft. Wow. Mm-hmm. And any part of you wish that you would have continued that journey as a Sherlock Holmes of Wells Fargo? There would have been some stuff to uncover along the way, wouldn't there have been?
there really was. But no, there's no part of me that would have wanted to continue that. I found myself often feeling incredibly struck by the stories of these people. I didn't end up dealing with the high-level bankers who are stealing millions of dollars. I ended up dealing with the bank teller who barely earns enough money to survive, whose husband, you know, there were incredible stories, most of which I think were real. Mm-hmm. And so I had tremendous empathy for these people who now were going to lose their jobs, fortunately for me. At that point in time, they didn't prosecute
okay.
employees, or at least none of the employees that I was involved with terminating from mm-hmm. the bank were prosecuted for their crimes. But of course, it's not good to have that your history.
Yeah. Was that before the time of checking your credit score and maybe your history of having any bankruptcies or anything like that for
yes.
people that were working at banks? Because that's changed now, hasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. My greatest yeah. story there yeah. is I worked with one young woman whose theft was discovered because she, at that point in time, they actually copied all of the checks that came through mm. on a deposit. So if it was a commercial account, they could have a 2-inch stack of checks that they were pushing through the copier. And sometimes there was cash in there as well. Mm-hmm. And she stole the cash out of a couple of deposits. And then she realized after that she copied the cash before she'd stolen it.
Right.
And so the numbers were not going to match and whatnot. So she took the, it was on film of some sort, so it wasn't the copiers that we're used to. And she flushed it down the toilet, which of course didn't work.
Right.
And so the plumbers found the filming itself. And when I talked with her about why did this happen, how did yeah. this happen, she literally said to me, I had an angel on one shoulder and a devil on the other shoulder, and I listened to the devil. Now, that one was hard for me to track with.
Yeah.
But she was in a very tough financial position, and so
wow, it trying to flush the evidence and having it not flush.
Yeah.
And so, so you're getting done with law school mm-hmm. In the 4 years, and what's drawing you to practice? What areas? What are you looking at?
I stayed at the position I was actually in during much of law school. Mm-hmm. I worked for a company that owned and managed hospitals mm-hmm. in the upper Midwest, and I worked in their quality and risk management areas. So there I was working with general and healthcare professional liability contracts, some employment issues, that kind of thing, and some environmental work. And I liked where I was, and they were pleased I finished law school, so they moved me into the legal department as well. So I was vice president of quality and risk management and associate general counsel.
Okay. And how long were you there?
I was there for 11 years in total, but 3 years of that I was in law school.
And was that in the Twin Cities?
Yes.
Okay. So then what brought you down to Omaha? How'd that happen?
Well, it was a relationship that brought me down to Omaha. I met who later became my husband through a friend and through a law school professor, actually. And we hit it off, and not long after that, I moved to Omaha. I worked initially for the CHI Help Initiative, it was at that point, in a similar kind of area, primarily with medical malpractice, hospital liability cases. And then a few years into my time here and our marriage, the in-house counsel for Lozier Corporation left. And she left sort of abruptly. It was a, you know, 2-week notice, and 1 week of that's going to be vacation time kind of thing. And so we agreed, my husband and I agreed, that I would be interim and do this, and we'd see how it worked. And meanwhile, they'd do a search. And so we did that, and I used my pre-marriage name, and it took about 10 seconds for everyone to know I was married to Alan anyway, so it didn't matter what I was calling myself. But that seemed to work. The search didn't work out that well. People seemed to deal with the fact that I was married to the owner without too much. That was at times an issue. People wouldn't push back as much with me as they might with someone else. Mm-hmm. And we tried to work with that and to manage that. But yeah, I've been here now 31 years.
Wow. When you were at CHI, did you work with Chuck Cederstrom at all?
I did not.
Didn't overlap mm-hmm. there? Okay. He's been on the pod and past president of the Omaha Bar. So I talked to him about his experience, but I know that was so long ago that he was sort of in the middle of things over there. So in your role here, tell us a bit about Lozier, the work it does, and what it's been like to have been general counsel over the years.
Okay. I was never general counsel.
Oh, sorry.
Legal counsel, and by that I mean that I was rarely involved with very, very high-level M&A kind of decisions.
Okay, right.
I was, as a co-owner, I didn't do the legal work. It's been an incredibly interesting period. When I started working, I was working with the Store Fixtures Manufacturing Company. That's where I worked for most of the time there. That's really been the heart and soul of Lozier. It's, I think of it as Alan's legacy. It's where 85% of the Lozier 2000-ish employees work. It has a very family-ish kind of culture, for the good and bad of that at times. Employees tend to have incredibly long tenure, and there's a lot of good that comes from that. It was a good fit for me for most of that time. My husband was a total workaholic. Toward the end of his career, he was literally, and I was, working 7 days a week and shorter hours on weekends at least, but sure. 7 days a week. And which I wouldn't recommend for anyone, by the way, but it really truly has been the heart and soul of the company. It's where all of the financial resources that have gone into everything else came from. So the foundation was born of that, the real estate company was born of that, etc. And so a few years into my work at the Store Fixtures Company, I kind of morphed into working with the foundation work. It had been set up in 1986 as obviously a mechanism for making charitable donations. There was one employee who worked in that area, worked very closely with Alan. So the foundation has very much his imprint. He would say, this is in a very popular term now, but he would say that the primary purpose of the foundation at that point in time was to try to level the playing field.
Sure.
Let's focus on the lower levels of the Maslow hierarchy and try to help raise people up. He and I both grew up in blue-collar, relatively poor families. His family, his parents owned a small business that he worked for as a young man, and ultimately they morphed into the store fixtures manufacturing company. They were a service company really at the start of that. My family was a little poorer. My dad was a tool and die guy. My mom stayed home most of the time. We had five kids, and we were literally on welfare at one point in time. I grew up feeling that my parents did the best they could. Neither graduated from high school. Their goal for all of us was to graduate from high school. I was obviously the first kid that went to law school, and in fact was the first kid that went to college. And interestingly, Alan, for all of his success, did go to college but didn't ever finish college. Clearly could have, but no question there. And as I started working with the foundation, we were able to broaden things a little bit. I was doing volunteer work with organizations that mostly served women and girls, the Women's Fund, which was started in 1990, and the what's now the WCA. And we did a lot of support work with Girls Inc. at that point in time. So that kind of filled my bucket and my interest in supporting women and girls. And then as we grew, we did capital work. We got to a point where we tried to reevaluate where we were, how we were funding and what kinds of programming or efforts we were funding, and realized that we really wanted to be supporting operating and programmatic work in agencies. Much more than community betterment, beautification. Those things are all really, really important and valuable and meaningful for a community. But other people liked giving money to those. And so we didn't feel like that was a place that we needed to be or that we wanted to be. But we also discovered that rather than giving the greater proportion of our funding to program and operating costs of primarily social service and health and education organizations, we were still giving more than half of the money that we were giving away to capital projects, which is kind of easy to do because they're such big dollars that are involved. And so we set about to change that, to minimize our capital gifts somewhat, but more so to give more in the social services world.
And I'm thinking to conversations of Bill and Melinda Gates and the intentional giving that they've done over the years, and how that really it gets away from you in terms of not following that path. And so to reassess and to get there makes a lot of sense. And there are so many capital campaigns for, you know, beautification of this, for building this building or this great thing in town. And we certainly have seen a lot of that over the recent years nearby the building that we're in right now, the landmark. But it's so important. And I've heard from people in the nonprofit community, general operating funds or funds for specific programs are so important, but it's much more difficult to raise for. But the day in, day out work really needs that support. And sometimes there's a disconnect with the philanthropic community on that. I'm just trying to make the point here. I guess it's well received, and appreciate that.
I totally agree with you. I think part of what happens there is that a capital campaign has a start and a finish, and you're done, and you've got this product that everybody can look at. Operating expenses go on forever, and if the organization is strong and successful, their need for operating expenses is only going to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that intimidates people that they're signing on to something that they're not sure they'll want to continue to be involved with forever.
Right.
Programs usually mean if the programs are successful, then they get folded into the operating, and so that again increases operating costs. But in our minds, we've always felt that what the organization does is way more important than what the building they work out of looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that the need for operating expenses is just very, very real and something that we all have to try to evaluate and fund if that fits with our interests and our focus.
Yeah. It sounds like over the years there's been just a greater and greater appreciation and belief in what you're doing, mm-hmm. Both you and Alan. Can you speak to that evolution in some respects? And as good works were supported and you saw the benefit of that, and it truly just... It spoke to you and to Alan?
Yeah, and it goes way back before me. Alan was a very, very strong supporter of what was Girls Club mm-hmm. at the time. And actually, at that point, was willing to go out and assist with fundraising for the organization. That urge passed, that willingness, I guess I should say, passed. But... He, a little bit of a funny story, he worked with them to fundraise, and he also was, and the company was, a strong supporter of United Way.
Mm-hmm.
And he learned through that knowledge and experience that United Way was funding Boys Club at a much higher level than it was funding Girls Club. And so he and the executive director went to the United Way and said, this isn't right. And Well Boys Club serves a lot more kids. Well Boys Club could serve a lot more kids. It had a lot more money.
Yeah.
So it had a lot more capacity. And he literally at that stage, which was also a part of Alan, said, okay, I'm going to stop funding the United Way.
Yeah.
Unless you... at least develop a plan to work toward parity there. Mm-hmm. And they did. So that was, I think that felt good to everyone involved and was an important message mm-hmm. to send.
Yeah, it's the work of Women's Fund as well is one that has such an impact on the community.
Mm-hmm.
And WCA obviously has grown and developed over the years to really do important work here in town. Still a drop in the bucket. Still so mm-hmm. much more can be done.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to hear from you some of the work that the Women's Fund has done that has been really impactful, if you have any stories or projects that they've been working on.
Sure. The Women's Fund has done a whole host of different things. One focus has always been women in leadership, to try to help get more women elected to public office or appointed to committees and commissions where they can have an impact. I think they're doing an even better job of that now. Mm-hmm. Initially, the Women's Fund was one part-time sort of executive director and a lot of volunteers
yeah.
doing things. But it's grown significantly since then. It's done a lot of work in recent history in health, especially adolescent health world, which has been very meaningful. And now it is doing, it is doing more work in the advocacy space,
yeah.
which I think they're doing an excellent job with. Jo Giles is the executive director there, and she's very strong and very committed. New experience to her to be the executive director in a position like that, in an organization like that, but I think they're doing particularly good work in advocacy.
And it connects so well with Lori Smith Camp, I think.
Yeah.
She was unapologetically women in leadership roles, mm-hmm. women first, give them the opportunities. Mm-hmm. She was a trailblazer, obviously, as the first federal female judge in Nebraska. She had a chip on her shoulder that because of her gender, she wasn't able to get into Stanford Law. And she practiced in a way that was unapologetically, I am here, I am a woman, I am here to help other women know that they can achieve anything they want to. Mm-hmm. And gender is not something that should hold you back. And it's just, it's a great legacy. And I think Women's Fund's doing such a great part to follow exactly what that is. So
I agree. And I think a really meaningful thing to me about Lori is that she could do all of that and take all of those positions and not back away, be assertive, but not generally put people off.
Right.
She did it in a way that was thoughtful and tried to encourage people to be more thoughtful and open their eyes to some things that they might otherwise not see. She was an amazing individual.
Yeah, that deafness is something that I struggle with. I cannot do. It was such a amazing strength that in real time you wouldn't think that you could do all those different things, but she was so good at it. And I always tell the story how she was an introvert that was amazing. Introvert, she had this goal of having all these impactful conversations in every meeting, but really she didn't want to, you know, instinctively that would drain her energy, but she knew how important it was to other people, and she knew how much of an impact she could have, and so she would lean into that discomfort and make her imprint on that. So important. So here in the Omaha community in Nebraska, we are trying to support all these programs. We're trying to be a better city, be a better community. Do you have any prescription for, and this is going to be a super wide question that's going to be totally unfair, but do you have any ideas on how we can move forward in the best way possible to support our communities? What do we need to be focusing on? What's important that maybe we can do a little bit better than we're doing now?
Yeah, no, easy question.
You're right, yeah, yeah.
I've got the prescription right here for how to deal with that.
30 seconds is all we have.
I think it's critical to focus, and that's something we don't necessarily do that well in our foundation because of me, because I have a lot of areas of interest and empathy for a lot of subjects and issues. But I think education is critically important. I think we don't appreciate how important it is, especially for young children, and it's foundational for them. It impacts our poverty levels. It impacts our crime levels. It has all sorts of potential, and it's hard. I mean, it's also very complicated. It's very expensive, but we have to be better about focusing on young children and early grade children. Not that we should ignore high school kids or anything like that, but we're not helping them by letting them get to that point. And reading is one of our great focuses. And if you get to ninth grade and you really, really can't read well at all, you're in a terrible, terrible spot. And making the choices that we would all want our children to be able to make, consistent with who they want to be and what kind of life they want to have, is just not available to a lot of those kids. So education is critically important to me. I like to see some of what we've done recently through the Department of Education, some legislation, and just building support for stronger approaches to early education, particularly in reading. We're just starting to do some work. We approached the Department of Education and said we'd really like to try to be helpful in any way we can with your reading initiatives, and we know you're going to have those. Mm-hmm. That's been made clear. We don't support all of the legislation that goes on with respect to education, but that's not a criticism of the Department of Education. We also think that Omaha needs to focus, like the rest of the country, on affordable housing. Mm-hmm. We have too many unhoused people with too many issues in their lives to be able to say, just shape up, you know, just go to the shelter and then everything will be fine, whatever it might be. Life is hard for most people. I cannot imagine trying to deal with all of the issues that I might have if I was unhoused. So we're trying to work with others. Yesterday, our foundation staff went to UNO and went through the Undesign the Red Line tour, I guess, lecture. And that was incredibly helpful, and it makes me come away thinking there's got to be something more that we can do with respect to affordable housing. I don't know what it's going to be yet, and we're going to reach out to some others to try to talk about it some more, because it's very complicated, gets very involved with government funding and credits and things I don't really understand very much at this point. But there's got to be a way. Mm-hmm. You know, the Omaha, in addition to having a lot of people who care a lot of heart, our own blind spots, has a lot of money to be able to do things with. And we just have to get some ideas about what might be helpful ways to do that, and then show the will to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. You talked about education, and before we were officially recording on the podcast, you talked about your first idea of maybe becoming a teacher.
Yes.
As a career, and education growing up for you, do you have any early memories that are really impactful on you? For me, it's going to the library as a child. That was a big thing for me. Any of those early education experiences that really were impactful for you that you remember?
The adults in my life who were the most impactful on me, obviously my parents were very impactful. I grew up feeling loved. I grew up being cared for. Education wasn't particularly strongly focused on, though, in my house. Again, I mentioned that graduating from high school was really the goal that our parents had for their kids. But my teachers challenged me and supported me, and I think generally liked me. I wasn't an acting out kid, so I wasn't a difficult kid. And so that's where my heart went. I didn't know any lawyers. I didn't know any doctors. I had neighbors who were in, you know, pretty much similar financial and educational situations as my family. So my teachers were the ones who inspired me. I had a fourth grade teacher who, when my mother, at that point kids didn't go to conferences, but when my mother came home from, nor did dads go to conferences often, when my mother came home from my school conference, she said, you know, Mr. Burkle says that you can be whatever you want to be. And that was the first time I'd ever heard anything like that. Mm-hmm. I didn't know exactly what I wanted to be, but that was very meaningful for me. And it's obviously now, 400 years later, I still remember the conversation.
Yeah, so. Yeah. And there are lots of, as you know, lots of opportunities for attorneys to support public service, to do it themselves, to donate time, to serve on boards and things like that around the community. And we have a lot of partners, Legal Aid of Nebraska, Nebraska State Bar Association, all these different initiatives out there for attorneys to use their skill set for good in part of their day, not necessarily their day job. Certainly they can, but there's also other initiatives for private practicing attorneys. And I think we need to talk about that, or we need to recognize that as something that anybody can do, regardless of if they have the ability to donate money. They have time that they can donate. That's important as well, and use those skills for good. Right? It's sometimes we get caught up in the day to day, and there's still, if it's, you know, 2 hours a month spent, it does make a difference. It can make a difference.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think it's important. You know, from a totally selfish standpoint, I think it's important to put yourself out there in that way, regardless of the kind of work you're doing. I guess I would recommend to people that they try to volunteer in a way that's not typical to what they do day in and day out in their real job. Being exposed to issues foster care kids are going through, or racial or ethnic minority people might be going through, or poor people might be going through, I think grounds you in a way that writing one more contract doesn't. I suppose it might, depending on the contract. Right. But for the most part, I don't think that you get the same kind of life experience. And I know lawyers are incredibly busy. They've got a lot of time demands. Young lawyers often work so many hours that it can be hard to try to figure out how you make that work. But I think it really is very, very worthwhile for them individually, for the organizations they work for, the law firms if they're in a firm, and to the people in the public that they can help.
When you say selfish, it really does feel good to give back at the end of the day. You may think that it's going to be a time stressor, but at the end, usually it comes back and you're like, well, that felt better for me. I don't know if they got anything out of it or as much out of it as I did.
Yeah, mentoring is something that you don't have. I would kind of freak out when I would get the letters about doing pro bono work, and it was about nothing I knew anything about. Yeah. I thought, I don't think people need incompetent lawyers. That won't be helpful to them. But mentoring is something that mostly everybody can do if they can get, you know, the support from the mentoring organization about how's a good way to do this. So I think there's something out there that everybody could find that they could invest some time in and have it feel and have it make a difference and have it feel really valuable to them.
Yeah. This has been a great conversation. That is all I have on questions. Was there anything that you wanted to talk about that we didn't cover? Anything that you'd like to let the attorneys and members of the community that are listening know about?
I really don't think so.
Okay. Well, it's as I said at the start, it's so special to have you as the award recipient this year for Lori Smith Camp Integrity and Service, because who Lori was, the integrity and service aspect to this award, it rings so true in the work that you do and who you are, and you are an excellent portrayal of exactly the good work that Lori did, the person that you are. There's just so much that you've done in the community. I'm glad we could shine a light on it, but also give other people some roadwork, some frame to maybe go and do something themselves along the way. So with that, I just want to say thank you. We look forward to seeing you on May 1st at our Law Day Luncheon. On behalf of the Omaha Bar Association, thanks for taking time.
Thank you.